I don't want to retire. And there is something about having to earn that gives you that bit of grit. And I think that grit is really important.
Are you in your 20s in a job you really don't like? Are you retired and bored? Are you stuck in a rut and can't see a way out? Fact is, the biggest barrier to getting onto the next curve is you. That's right. It is never too late or too early to be who you want to be. My name is Dee Sterling. I'm a businesswoman, a presenter, and we are back with our new show, Second Carvers. We will reframe familiar problems and let you take control. Are you a second carver ready to be ignited? Welcome to the spectacular Shan Sutherland. Hi, Shan. How are you?
Oh, thank you, Dee. That's a great intro to start with. It's going to be fun.
So I'm in London and you're in lovely sunny Portugal.
I am. I'm living, working in Lisbon for 3 weeks just to get under the skin of a different city. I think it's really important for us to lift our heads up sometimes and have a different view.
Fantastic. So Shan, listen, you have had and continue to have a long, exciting, adventurous career as an entrepreneur, as a turbocharged power businesswoman. And you've worked in different areas that you're passionate about, from restaurants and getting a Michelin star, no less, to film, to creative design and branding and skincare. And at a number of junctions on this superhighway that you've been traveling along, you have retired effectively out of some business successes and then explored other avenues. And, you know, you've gone off, you've broken down walls, you've built new ventures and new success stories. I would like to touch on a couple of these because I think they're really indicative of who you are as a person. I know you're passionate about life is for living and life is for learning and what they say about you and how you brought that to your approach, not just in life, but in business with all the different things that you've worked on and ultimately A Plastic Planet, which is now your life's mission. But if we start back, you were in your 20s, you love food, you decide to set up a restaurant. Within a year, you've got a Michelin star. What did you learn about that? And why did you retire out of the restaurant business to get onto your next venture?
There is a great line from, I don't know if anybody remembers, the restaurant critic, Igor Rone.
Of course.
The Igor Rone guide used to be a very big thing. And Igor Rone famously said, if you can run a restaurant, you can run the country. And I have to say, of everything that I've done, what is probably the hardest job I've ever done, it's running a restaurant. And I love Dee that you said, I loved food and I set up a restaurant. Actually, if I'm really honest, I was no gourmand at all. You know, I grew up family of six. My mum would definitely confess to not being a great cook. And so food was not that in that way a massive part of my upbringing. And then I started working in London. I worked in advertising and I got to 25 and I just thought, I want to set up my first business. I feel that I'm ready. I became part of the merging of four agencies to become one big massive agency in the mid-80s, which was the heyday of advertising. So it was a really fun time to be in that business. But I realized when we were creating this big agency, that wasn't for me. I'm a small company person. I like building things. I like small teams. So I thought, okay, I'm going to set up my first business. And then I randomly, to be honest, thought, isn't it a wonderful thing to create a restaurant and give people an experience that just makes them feel happy? And I remember going to see, because at that time, Lascargo in Greek Street was the restaurant, with Nick Lander owning it and Chances Robinson was, you know, obviously his wife. Both of them still writing for the Financial Times.
Right.
Restaurants and wine critic. Amazing longevity there. Martin Lamb was the chef. We used to have a lot of events at Lascargo. And I remember going to see Nick Lander and saying, hey, I'm thinking of setting up a restaurant in Soho. He said, come and work here for a year. I'll put you off. They were his words.
Literally.
And I did. I went and I worked in the kitchens and I worked with the incredible legend, Eleanor, in the barrel vaulted room of Lascargo. And I learned, I'd never picked a plate up. I had no experience in restaurants at all. And I also went back to my original job as a freelance consultant. And I got involved in a post-production company because, of course, I had to earn the money. even doing 11 shifts a week at Escargot, your feet might want to drop off, but you couldn't pay the mortgage. So I had to do three jobs for a year. And that, again, was really great experience for me of just spreading my fingers into different pies.
And learning, right?
Yeah, learning on all of those things. And then, of course, I realized everything always, and that is the thread that you'll see through all of my different businesses. I had to build a team because, you know, here was me, could barely cook, could, you know, barely knew anything about a restaurant, randomly thinking, let's open a restaurant in Soho. I found a building in Lexington Street, which was really the arse end of Soho at the time, opposite an infamous wine bar called Andrew Edmonds, which is still there. And there's so many stories about Andrew Edmonds, and anybody listening that goes there knows it's not a place of sobriety. Things happen in Andrew Edmonds. We were the building opposite. And I found a restaurant manager, and Christian Arden, who, as you know, is now,
I know, we love him, 32
years married this year. So, but he was my restaurant manager.
There are no coincidences, right?
Exactly. And then my chef, Gary Holyhead, who was premier sous chef at the Savoy. So fundamentally, it's about building the team. And then we opened our doors. And I think on day one, we had Faye Mashula, who was still writing for the Evening Standard.
Incredible.
We had Drew Smith, who was the editor of the Good Food Guide at the time. This is pre-internet, pre-Google. So the guides and newspaper critics were incredibly powerful then. And as you say, yes, in the first year, we won a Michelin star, newcomer of the year in the Good Food Guide. So amazing, amazing success. However, the kiss of death, because when you have a Michelin star, you also have all the baggage that comes with that. And there is a reason why many, many chefs give their stars back, because they don't want the pressure of you've now got to keep it, or do you try and get two?
And you're at zero every single day, aren't you? And forget running other businesses you and I have been involved in, where it's zero at the beginning of every month. It's literally every day.
Every day, exactly. You know, coming from advertising, it was like a new business pitch every single day. And wonderful. And some days I would lock that door at 2 a.m. thinking I've got the best job in the world, but so mercurial, also a terrible business. And I'd lock that door thinking, I hope it burns down overnight and I never see it again.
The highs and the lows.
Yeah, I'm fine. Really, the most mercurial thing I've ever done. And all the things that you've ever heard, from kitchen nightmares and Gordon Ramsay tales, they're absolutely right. Me, front of the house, walking amidst the tables, no main courses coming upstairs, wondering what's going on, going down to the kitchen. My chef is being arrested. The police are in the kitchen because he held the pot wash up against the wall with a knife at his throat because the pan wasn't right. So all of those things that you've ever heard, you could double them. They are all absolutely right. And it was an amazing time. It was the beginning of new British cuisine, really.
Right. Everything
was happening. So, and also I went from an industry where people earned a lot of money and egos were big, to an industry where people earned very little money and they worked unbelievably hard. But also egos were still a decent size, because it was the growth of the super chef.
So why did you decide to leave and step out of that? You know, you were in the thick of it. You'd achieved, you'd gotten the star. You know, it was all going your way with the wind at your back. Why did you decide to, you know, retire from that industry as such?
Two reasons. One, economics, that we didn't need two people front of house. And we had the Gulf War halfway through. So we went from having a waiting list and Americans, you know, lining up outside the door to zero Americans. And anybody who had a Michelin level restaurant really suffered at that time, because the American tourist was your bread and butter in the evenings. So economics, definitely, two of us being front of house wasn't really needed. And also, there is definitely a thing with me that it's generally every 7 years that I feel ready to do something else, to take that experience and get involved in something new. And of course, I was then having a relationship with Christian, and it's anyone who works with their partner, kudos to them. It's an incredibly difficult thing to do. So I went back to my marketing roots and set up a branding agency called Miller Sutherland with Kathy Miller, amazing creative partner. And we had some very happy years of really working in the two categories of branding that we loved, and that was drink. And it's interesting being back in Portugal, because we did a huge amount of work for Taylor's Port, who owned Fonseca and many others. Wonderful, wonderful experiences with those guys, family owned up in Porto. And then also personal care. the whole beauty world. So we spent years building this small boutique branding packaging agency, focusing in those two areas. And we also had our baby making years. And that's where my next business idea really came from, was creating these products that helped us through pregnancy, through our little black book of amazing aromatherapists and skincare specialists to help us through that 9-month stretch. And then recognizing, why does this range not exist? Why is there nothing for you when you fall pregnant and you have your first genuine skincare need? Hence, creating the skincare brand Mamma Mio and launching that in the US back in, now, I think it was 2005.
And it was genius. And actually, when we, you know, at that time, as we know, there wasn't anything like it, right? I mean, there weren't even, I remember when I was in my corporate career, the beginning of my career, there weren't even nice pregnancy clothes. I mean, there was really not a lot in that market. And how the world has shifted, but also it was genius in a way. Like all great entrepreneurs, you identify a need that you had yourselves, and it also happened to be a gap in the market. And of course, many years later, you expanded the brand, you went global, it became Mio, Fit Skin for Life, and you sold it to the Hut Group a few years ago. Can we go to that point, Shan? You know, often when people sell their business, it has been their baby. And I know it was you, there was a group of you involved, and you'd been down many roads together. So it was the end of an era in some respects, and a point of inflection, right? And you'd been at it a long time. It wasn't a walk in the park. These things never are, you know. And where were you at in your mindset at the time? You know, some people would have gone off on a little holiday. You might have gone sailing around the world because you love your sailing. Somebody else might have written a book. What were you thinking at that time? How did you feel? And how did you get on to your next and current mega venture?
There are different ways of measuring success, aren't there, Dee? And I look back at every career move that I've made. And if I were probably a better entrepreneur, I could have gone and sailed around the world. But the reality is that Christian and I, we have lived the roller coaster of entrepreneurship. Our poor sons have lived that roller coaster with us. I'm amazed that they haven't gone into the civil service or something that is guaranteed with a pension at the end, a bit of job security. But actually, both of them are very entrepreneurial.
Right.
And so when we came to that point, obviously founded the skincare brand, we launched in America, massively competitive market, undercapitalized from day one, which will be no surprise to anybody, because the whole world of skincare is driven around a massive marketing budget and opening up new market opportunities. And all of this costs money. Developing new products costs money.
And you have to keep developing, right? You mean, you know, it's every week, every month, there's got to be, you know, some new news, even if it isn't a new product development or a new innovation, but you have to have that coming down the track the whole time, right?
That was one of the things I really pushed against. Every time you'd meet the buyers or the press, they'd say, what do you got new? And I'd be the one saying, show me a different skincare need that pregnant women have, or generally women have, and we'll create something new. But the madness of us creating newness for newness sake was very frustrating. So one of the fortunate things about being a skincare brand for pregnancy is that every 9 months you have a new market. They don't need anything new. They just need stuff to work. They need something that celebrates them on this highly emotional way. You know, your confidence, your body confidence takes a massive hit. So they need a brand that nurtures them through that. So it was wonderful for me after, it wasn't quite 7 years. My 7-year itch was prolonged a bit. It was 11 years by the time that we'd finally sold to the Hut Group. But it was wonderful to meet women who would say, I've had 3 babies on Mamma Mio. So it was such an extraordinary
beautiful
thing.
Right?
Yeah, so beautiful. And we knew that the fragrance and the experience and all of it was something which was incredibly emotional for them. It wasn't an acne cream or a wrinkle cream. It was something that, you know, you're making a miracle. You're growing a baby. So it's a lovely emotional thing to do. And so we came to the point then of thinking we had come to the end of our road. And we met an incredible company who wanted to buy us. And then interestingly, they didn't buy us. They realized that they couldn't complete on the deal. But I'm sure some people will relate to this. Emotionally, we'd sold, even though we hadn't
ready. Yeah.
We were ready to sell. So we were all ready for thinking, what's our individual next chapters? And then it didn't go through. And then we ended up selling to the Hot Group, which was not, you know, the financial deal that we ideally would have wanted. So nobody left with life-changing amounts of money. But we left with freedom to be able to think, what's our next stage? And of course, along the way, we diluted many, many times because you're constantly
you do, right?
Yeah, in that kind of industry. So people always think, oh, so you sold your business, so therefore you can afford to do what you're doing now, which is actually not the truth. I've never been able to just be able to slip into that role of, I don't know, philanthropy. We've always lived beyond our means. We've always borrowed ridiculous amounts to fund business ventures, both Christian and I. And that has meant that retirement is never anything that we have. I wouldn't even say the privilege to contemplate, because I don't want to retire.
Quite.
And there is something about having to earn that gives you that bit of grit. And I think that grit is really important. I think you can see so many people where money isn't important and therefore it doesn't matter if things fail. I've never been in that position where we could give things a go. And if it doesn't work, so be it. I can take a risk. I can afford to take the risk. I've never been in that position where I can afford to take the risk and it not work. And therefore you give it your all. So in some ways, much as it would be lovely to have less mortgages and a big fat bank account that I could lean back on and a pension scheme. And many of our contemporaries and friends now are in that position because they had corporate jobs and they can now start to relax and think, oh, what can I do next? Because they've got that comfort blanket of a pension scheme. We don't have that. So, but I don't mind at all because I think it spurs us on to do other things and other things that mean that have to be successful.
I couldn't agree more.
We can't play at stuff. I've never been able to.
It's not playing, right? And thank you for sharing that. I think it's such an important point because we are in this kind of archetype of what's expected in the Western world, you know? And the world doesn't look like that anymore. We know that. And, you know, we also know for our children, our children's children, they will not be going into the types of businesses we maybe started our careers in because of the enormous shifts that have happened in how technology is used, AI and so forth. There won't be the longevity. We're in a DIY economy. You look after yourself, you do it yourself, et cetera, et cetera. I also think that from a kind of personal fulfillment perspective, everybody's better if they get up in the morning and have a mission that drives them forward, whatever that is, right? It doesn't have to be grandiose, but something that gets them up and out and engages them with the world at large. So Shan, you and the spectacular Friederike Magnussen founded A Plastic Planet a number of years ago. And really you started out with one goal, to turn off the toxic, wasteful, diabolical plastic tap. Globally, right? If I synthesize somewhat. I'd love to come back to kind of where it started, because the fact is, as you and I know, often people are very unhappy in what they're doing professionally, or they feel they've come to the end of the track in their job, or they've, you know, gone through the cycle and are ready for something else. And they maybe sit occasionally with their intuition and think, oh, I really want to write that book, or I really want to go back to academic life, or whatever it is. But they cannot get through the wall of fear. They don't know where to start. They can't take the leap of faith. What did you do and what would you tell those people? Because there are so many of them at all ages and stages that want to exit where they're at in life, in business, in relationships, and get on with something that they're excited about, but they just don't know how to take the first step.
If I've got any superpower, is a big, too big a word, but if I've got any...
No, it's a superpower.
Okay, let's call it super. If I've got any superpower at all, it's my radical naivety. And I talk about it a lot that it's just, I don't know the reasons why not. So through every part of my career, I didn't know how to open a restaurant, but I knew how I wanted to feel when I go to a restaurant. I had knew nothing about a skincare brand, didn't know how to make skincare. I hadn't come through the ranks of Estée Lauder or L'Oreal, but I knew how I wanted products to make me feel. And I knew how I wanted to be sold to, I wanted to be communicated to. So I think that radical naivety of not treading the traditional path and embracing the fact that you don't know things is really, really empowering. And what I'm doing now in the whole world of, as you say, fighting plastic, what I feel is the radical naivety superpower is stronger than ever. Because when I meet with people like Kraft Heinz and Unilever, and last week we were in Brussels with the MEPs talking about the toxicity of the chemicals in plastic, all of these different things, it's having that clarity of thought, because you don't know the reasons why not. You just know it's wrong. And we need to get to the other side, and we think things are impossible. We think the future is just inevitable and just it's unfurling in front of us, and it isn't the future we want. Then change it.
Yeah, we do something.
We invent our future. Our future doesn't just happen. We make our future happen.
Yeah, totally.
So I feel going into things and just never feel that being naive is a downside. It's not. It's an absolute superpower. And so when people are saying, I'll tell you the reasons you can't do it that way, then stick your fingers in your ears and go, la, 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 I don't want to know. Tell me that. Because then you cannot move forward. And the whole thing about being an entrepreneur is you have to keep things super simple. You have to know where the end goal is, and then you can build a roadmap to it. But it might not be the end goal that industry currently talks about and dictates and considers the status quo and inevitable. And we've got to radically rethink what our future is going to look like. We owe that to next generations. I feel very passionately about this. Look at me, massive plastic sinner. How many millions of plastic bottles have I pumped out into the environment running a skincare brand? Didn't even think about what happens to them next. And then obviously had my own personal epiphany, realized what we were doing, created A Plastic Planet, which is an organization with a very, very different raison d'etre, which is working with business, empowering business, bringing them solutions, and then also working with governments to put pressure on business to create that level playing field and that imperative to change. Nothing to do with Joe Public, nothing to do with the shoppers, the consumer, because it's not our problem. This, you know, plastic is a design problem. And I feel that there is a real opportunity through this window, the lens of plastic, for us to create a different vision of a different future, because plastic is the material that where we just went wrong. We broke the model, our original societal model, where we would buy something, we would take from nature, we would buy something, we would make something, and then we would repair it, refill it, reuse it, rent it, share it.
And have a circular economy, right? Yeah, like everything had a purpose. And you know, it's the kind of, you know, you've referred to sort of the luxury of having things that last, right? And not throwing things away, and not and you know, we know recycling is just a total waste of time, and we'll come on to that. But Sean, when you started, you know, you had your personal epiphany, you and Fred decided to get going, and you know, you're both entrepreneurs. And you believe very much in the power of business, you know, to transform things and at scale and at speed, which is obviously crucial, particularly, I mean, in life and in business, but particularly where we are environmentally today. But how did you get going? Because it's one thing going, oh God, I was a plastic addict. I'm actually going to do something about it. We're on a time bomb. And getting going. And obviously, look at where you are today. And there have been so many achievements on the road, which we'll come on to. But what did you do? Where did you start?
It's quite a funny story, Dee. So Fred and I, the reason I got involved is Fred and I were consulting on the launch of a film called A Plastic Ocean.
Yes, incredible film.
First documentary. You know, now you will watch it and it's a little dated because it does talk about recycling plastic as being part of the answer. But an amazing achievement. It took 8 years of these very passionate people, virtually self-funded, to make this film about the problem of plastic in the ocean. And it was one of the screenings of that film, which was at the Electric in Notting Hill. And luckily, you know, we had David Attenborough coming. So this was pre-Blue Planet too. Nobody knew what, you know, the problem of plastic in the ocean. So you can imagine nobody wanted to come and see that. Well, that sounds like a downer of a film. So we bribed people with dinner and all the rest of it. And then I remember saying to the people that ran the Plastic Ocean Foundation, so what's the takeaway for people here? They're going to feel scared and guilty and angry, but then they're going to go shopping tomorrow and they're going to be force-fed plastic wherever they go. So what could we do? And they gave us this little postcard to be printed. And that postcard said was all about the three R's. And I remember turning to Fred and just saying, it's kind of bullshit. We've been talking about this for decades. None of it is working. I wonder if there's a way of creating a different kind of business, which is pro-business, pro-solution. We don't talk about the problem. We really just talk about what is our future going to look like? What are the new materials, the new systems that get us back into that take, make, repair, renew, all of those things.
Yeah. Reuse.
From our top one, yeah, which is now take, make, chuck it in a bin, which is plastic enabled us to create this single-use culture. So we said, wouldn't it be amazing if we just went to our supermarkets and we said, give us an aisle. Just give us one aisle out of your 40 aisles where we have got the right to buy plastic-free. Because why can we buy fat-free, dairy-free, gluten-free, all of these things free, but we can't buy plastic-free? Now we know what we know. And so we decided, right, we're going to create this company. And then we planted a media release about the idea of giving a plastic-free aisle. We hadn't spoken to anybody. We hadn't talked to any supermarket. We'd done nothing. It was the front page of the Telegraph on a Saturday morning.
I remember. It was massive.
Supermarket urge to create plastic-free aisle. Right. And then the phone started ringing. And I was down at our tiny little cottage in Dorset on the coast. And suddenly it was, I'm on Sky News. Nobody did Sky News.
No, there was no Zooming then, right?
On your computer, yeah. So suddenly I'm rigging the lights and moving the backdrop and getting everything ready. And then, boom, I'm on Sky News. And they're saying, Sushant, tell me, what does the government say? And what do the supermarkets say? And I kind of blagged my way through this interview. And then we thought, right, that's it. We're doing this now. And that was really the beginning of us doing it. So you know that whole thing of be careful what you wish for and what belief becomes actuality. It was definitely that. And then we met with all the supermarkets and we did a lot more media work. Our amazing communications agency, Higginson Strategy, found us and said, we'd love to be your back office and help you drive this campaign. And then finally, this incredible, inspirational guy in Amsterdam said, I'm going to be the world's first to open a plastic-free aisle. And the day that we opened that aisle, and since then, in that time that elapsed, Blue Planet 2 had happened, the world had woken up. And we opened the aisle in February 2018, the suburbs of Amsterdam. And I did 55 media interviews on that one day.
Insane.
Because it was this symbol of hope. And that, I think, is really indicative of how we work at A Plastic Planet. We don't talk about the problem. We show that a different future is possible. And we have to now just demonstrate that all the time. So one of our campaigns at the sachet is, let's ban the trillion plastic sachets globally. Call on governments for that. Whilst at the same time, we work with Kraft Heinz on how can we fix the infamous, iconic Heinz tomato ketchup sachet. Because as an entrepreneur, that's the only way that I see going forward is it's not enough to call business out. We have to help them change.
Absolutely. So you're working with major global corporations. You know, you've mentioned a couple, but they're the big ones that everyone knows. You're working with nation states. You're working with governments. You're working with policymakers. You're working with academics. What have been the big achievements so far? And then I'd love to talk about Plastic Free, this incredible, incredible platform and why it's so important.
What have been our achievements so far? What a great question, Dee. I would say, obviously the opening of the aisle, because that went globally.
That was the beginning, right?
Yeah. And that was a symbol of hope. The other thing that I'm really proud of is the recognition at government that we have to ban things. And the EU are so far ahead. So this constant pressure is really important. I'm very proud that we sit on the Stewardship Council of the UN Global Plastic Treaty.
Yeah, dialogues. Massive.
So this is the convenings where we have the petrochemical industry, ExxonMobil, American Chemistry Council, Dow, sitting together with Greenpeace and all the brands in the middle to find, if possible, points of consensus to push that treaty forward. I think the only way that we're going to get out of this mess is we are united by one ocean. So we have to have global policies. And much as the Paris Agreement was this pivotal moment in climate history, it's voluntary, and most member states are failing in the commitments that we all made in the Paris Agreement on greenhouse gas emission reductions. The plastics treaty will be legally binding. It's happening at breakneck speed. Yeah, so I think I'm really proud of. And then also I work with the Plastic Health Coalition.
Which sounds incredible.
Yeah, all the scientists to really, because if we look at what is the tipping point going to be, look at plastic, it's such an amazing material. It's everywhere. It's in the paint on our walls. It's 70% of all of our clothing. It's so omnipresent in our lives that we cannot imagine life without it. So what will be the thing that tips us into adopting new materials and new systems where we live less in that single-use culture, it's going to be the impact on human health. So backing the scientists and bringing their incredible work to the fore and making sure it gets more oxygen is a really important part of our work, working with the incredible Plastic Soup Foundation, Maria Vesterbos. So that we see to be a big tipping point for mankind, really, because if you want to make business change fast, there are two ways. And one of them is about money and having to move the money. And the second is about risk. And risk is the biggest catalyst for change. So that's something that we're really focused on. If we prove the impact on human health, and there is so much science out there already, we don't need loads more, then you know that the corporations have to change because of this impending juggernaut of risk.
Right. And it's really coming very quickly down the tracks, isn't it? Shan, tell me about Plastic Free. Tell me about this platform, you know, why it was launched, how it's going, what the vision is for this, because it's really groundbreaking.
We work a lot with brands and creative agencies. We became acutely aware of this huge knowledge gap between the creative industry and the plastic-free systems makers and materials. Because when you go to an art college, a packaging design course, any of those things, architectural course, then a lot of the time you grow up through those ranks learning how to use plastic because it has become the omnipresent material, the default for almost everything. And yet, what we need is to connect that audience. There are 160 million global creators. Everything in our lives is designed, even if it's a bad design. Everything, the city that I'm living in, you know, everything that you're wearing, the microphone, everything in our lives is designed. If we can change the way that we design, then we can turn off the tap of plastic. So we can connect these 160 million global creatives with the solutions of the future, the materials of the future, the systems change of the future. I think that we can catalyze change much earlier on. So we really encourage the designers of the world to educate themselves. It's no longer acceptable to think that you went to art college to create branded trash. Nobody wants to do that anymore.
Nobody, it's such a lack of honesty and integrity in that approach, right? So you're really encouraging them to kind of get turbocharged as a collective as well, right?
Yes.
Rethink how they do things as a collective. Share innovation. Right.
Exactly.
Work together.
That was the creation of Plastic Free.
Yeah.
So hosted on plasticfree.com. It's a materials library, but it's so much more than that. Hundreds, thousands of case studies and proof points, because everybody needs to see how a material's in action actually being used. A lot of conversation about what is the future of retail going to be. And I can see a day where we will open our bathroom cabinets and our food cupboards and think, why was it ever okay for us to have this Jurassic Park of colored plastic containing everything that we then use and then chuck into a bin? And we will have this new future system of permanent packaging, standardization across industry, where Procter & Gamble and Unilever, whatever that, and L'Oreal, that 250ml bottle of shampoo is a metal standardized bottle that you simply change the label on. And actually what we're buying, of course, is not this piece of toxic plastic we throw away and we become complicit in the problem, but we just become part of this system that then that piece of metal packaging can go back into. And it isn't just about a refill store, because I think we will demand a level of convenience that we're addicted to convenience now. I'm never going to remember to bring all my stuff back to a supermarket and spend 3 minutes filling up my shampoo bottle. It's not going to be part of my life. So the fact that we're going to have things pre-filled with standardized componentry across competitive brands with thousands of drop-off points, and eventually I hope there'll be a bin in your kitchen, which will be the reusable bin, a smart bin that recognizes every piece of packaging that rewards me for living this different way. Wouldn't that be wonderful?
Oh, it'd be absolutely incredible. And you're totally right, because people, even with privacy, for example, people prefer ease of access to privacy. So people are not changing their passwords on a regular basis or shaking up a system on their order, you know, with Tesco or Ocado or Amazon or whatever. Because it's too much effort. And people are intrinsically lazy. And, you know, often I think people are very discouraged, right? Because they think, well, what can I do? Even if I'm doing my bit with my recycling, is that going to move the dial, right? Now, with Plastic Free, one of the aims that I think has been mentioned is really eradicating, you know, the use of trillions of pieces of plastic in fairly short order. If you stand back momentarily and look at what's been achieved so far. How far off are we? Because there is a lot of catastrophizing when we talk about the environment. And, you know, we have reason to be worried and concerned, right? We don't actually have that long. And it's not someone making it up. We know, having talked to world experts and so forth, and you work with these people, that we are on, you know, that the clock is ticking very, very loudly. Of course, often there's not enough of a shout out to all the technological innovation that's actually helping the planet. And, you know, if we could put more, not just philanthropic money, but investment in to some of these innovations, it would really move the dial. But what is your sense when you look out to the horizon about where we're at, how far off we are from where we need to be, and, you know, your degree of hope as you look out?
I'm a natural born optimist, which I think as an entrepreneur you have to be. However, if you listen to the scientists, exactly as you say, the clock is not just ticking, it's 5 past midnight. And we need to act much, much faster. I'm an optimist because I think the human race are unbelievably inventive and we are incredibly selfish. And as soon as our own future livable planet and security is threatened, we are capable of doing extraordinary things. COVID proved that. And if we could treat the climate emergency with the same level of urgency as we treated COVID, then I think we could do extraordinary things. The problem is that it touches everybody and it touches most of the 1%. And if we look at the 1% and we look at where it's all about moving the money, the master will never dismantle the master's house using the master's tools.
Yeah, and so true.
If we expect the uber privileged, educated, elite 0.001%, the McKinseys of the world, the JP Morgans of the world, to fix what we need to do for the climate crisis, to actually give climate justice to the global south, who of course did not cause the problem and are the ones that are going to feel the impact. The inequality of that just smacks me right between the eyes every time I think about it. If we expect that uber elite to fix this, then we're going to be severely disappointed. They are squeezing every last drop of profit out of the status quo, because the change that needs to happen is so extraordinary. But if we did it, I think the future is unbelievable. And it is so exciting and optimistic and better, and we will be happier. There is no coincidence that the climate crisis is happening at the same time as the mental health crisis. We've disconnected ourselves from nature, and we need to plug back into nature in a way that we never could imagine is possible. We need to get into her slipstream in everything that we do. And we need to take the money away from fossil fuels as quickly as possible. And we need to move these trillions and trillions of dollars from the state pension funds, all of these things. We need to move the money. So anybody who is in this world, I know it's difficult. Of course it's difficult. But that this is where we need radical naivety of thinking, forget the reasons why not. And let's focus on that bright, optimistic future. And to get there, we have to dramatically move the money. We have to take a lot less resource from the planet. In the last 6 years, we've taken more natural resource than in the entire 20th century.
No, it's utterly shocking. Isn't it?
So, of course, we have to stop taking the resources from our children's future, selling them today and calling it GDP. This is nonsense. We're living on borrowed time, borrowed resources. The rent is very, very high. And it is coming back to roost. And when you talk to the scientists, it's coming so much faster than we thought. Last year, 2022, we had 7 once in 1,000 years extreme weather occurrences. 7 in 1 year. This year is already set to be another very, very hot year for the planet. And this means less crops are being grown in Europe. This is not just something happening in faraway islands. This is happening here. Last year, 25% less crops were grown in Italy. These things have not yet come to hit us, but they will. And so we need to really think fast. And who are going to be the people that lead us out of this? We're going to need new leaders.
New leaders, and thinking in a different way without these short-term agendas about how to get re-elected. And, you know, to your point earlier about, you know, the underdeveloped world, a lot of those countries are actually doing quite a good job with the means they have to be environmentally friendly, to not to be, you know, wreaking havoc on their own fields and land. And they're shackled because, you know, they've been given loans from the West, right? They're never going to be able to repay these loans. So it creates another type of vicious circle for them. When we drill it down to the individual level, what can the consumer do? Because obviously, and you've always said this, if you're walking down an aisle in a supermarket and everything's covered in plastic, you have no choice. You know, you need to feed yourself, your family, whatever. You've only got what's in front of you. But what would you say to people who really want to engage and do more and, you know, have understood that recycling is really a waste of time? What are the couple of things that they can do to contribute in their own way?
I don't know if you know, Dee, what the etymology of the word consumer is. Because it's such an interesting thing that, you know, we've used it talking today. Everybody talks about being, you know, what about me, the consumer? We define ourselves as consumers. And the etymology of that word is actually, it's a 15th century word that means to squander or to waste.
Oh, well, there you go.
Doesn't that just say everything to you?
Everything, as a linguist. Everything. I mean, even more so, but yes.
So I love that definition. And then, of course, you look at what is the definition, the derivation of the word citizen, which is to contribute, to belong. And all of us now, there is this big movement to stop defining us as consumers, as these vessels, you know, to be filled with more and more and more stuff.
That we don't need, right?
That we don't need, because it's not going to make us happy. And I've just been involved in this fantastic, I must give you a copy, journal called To Think, that I have co-edited with my great friend and colleague, Ben Parker, who is creative co-founder of Made Thought. And in To Think, we posed a question of how can we think about our bright, optimistic future when we're shackled to our present? And we interviewed all of these maverick thinkers, amazing people, people like Dr. Vandana Shiva, who wrote the book, Who Really Feeds the World, incredible book if anybody wants it, but amazing people throughout. But one of them was J.B. McKinnon. J.B. McKinnon is a Canadian journalist who wrote the book, The 100-Mile Diet. And he also wrote the book, The Day the World Stopped Shopping. And so we spent an hour and a half talking to him. So fascinating. And
incredible.
Talked about people who had stepped off that hamster wheel. The hamster wheel of we've got to earn more in order to buy more and live the lives that we think are going to make us happy. And at the end of it, I was saying, you've made me feel very guilty about my consumerism. And he said, don't feel guilty, because you have been bred to be a consumer. From the minute you were born, you are bred to be a consumer. So my only thing for when you think about what can you do as an individual would be, we need to buy less.
Buy less.
Just right? Buy less. And if you look at the world of fashion, fashion could not exist without fossil fuels. Fast fashion, the average number of times that an item of clothing is worn is 7.
And it's shocking.
And the amount of time that it is kept within your wardrobe before it's discarded is 1 year. So let's fall in love with the things we already own. Let's buy vintage clothing, pre-loved. Let's be more distinctive with our personal style, all of those things. And it's so easy for us to think, oh, the world's going, you know, to hell in a handcart, whatever that expression is. I'll just make myself happy, ding, buy now, little 12-minute dopamine hit. That's what we've got to wean ourselves off. Because if we can just demonstrate by buying less, I think that's your strongest power is to buy less. And then your second strongest power is, what do you do at work? So when we say, don't bother about recycling, obviously I'm only talking about recycling plastic. Recycle all the other things, but don't be fooled that there's a plastic recycling fairy when we're still exporting 60% of our plastic waste. But what you do at work is actually your superpower. But anybody who is thinking, oh no, I'm entering those retiring years, I really, really encourage them. We are the generation that have made this mess. We have to also be the generation that gets ourselves out of this mess. So use your skills, use your connections, use all your power that you possibly can to fix the mess that we have created. In whatever you do, whether it's setting something up, or getting involved, or backing people, or lobbying your local MP, get involved, be vocal. Somebody said to me, do you think business should get involved in government policies? I said, I don't understand that question. Do you pay corporation tax? Where does your corporation tax go? Do you pay, you know, employers, national insurance? Where do you think that money goes? You have a right to be part of that calculation. And at the moment—
And that dialogue, right?
Yeah. So everybody needs to get involved. Our governments are weak without industry. They will only do what industry tells them to do. So if industry says we want to change, we want to operate industry in a different way. We want to wean ourselves off our single-use culture. We want taxing in a different way. Somebody said to me, wouldn't it be amazing if every B Corp, if you work for a B Corp, you paid no income tax. Imagine that.
I know, incredible. No,
we need more radical policies like that. And if you have been or are thinking of moving within your field of work, think how business is the tool of change. It is the most powerful tool we have for scale and speed. So choose something where you know that you're going to have an impact, because this is your legacy right now.
It totally is. And it's the legacy of absolutely everybody. So there's frankly no time to retire, because everyone should be acting, right? In whatever capacity they can. You've always said, Shan, where there's change, there's an opportunity, right? And we are in times of radical change, and hence the opportunity. What is your biggest challenge today in your mission with plastic? What would the one thing that you'd point to be, if there were one?
The power of the fossil fuel lobbyists is absolutely phenomenal. So at the moment, even with everything that we know about the toxic chemicals in plastic, about the single-use culture that it is really enabled, the problems of plastic pollution everywhere, and now, of course, in our own bodies. Even though we know all of these things, plastic is plan B for the fossil fuel industry. It's the soft landing for big plastic and big oil.
So plan B. I mean, that's so true. So true.
It's on course to treble by 2040. So we need help really pushing through these very, very powerful lobbyists, because the fossil fuel industry, of course, have had decades of extremely clever communication and lobbying activity. So probably our biggest opportunity is to create the UN Global Plastics Treaty with teeth, impact, something that truly addresses the impact on human health, the full life cycle of plastic, all the things that at the moment the negotiators are saying will be on the table. Already we have Japan and the US saying that let's not consider human health as part of the negotiations.
I mean, shocking, seriously.
Yeah, shocking. That's, when America is saying that, you know how powerful big plastic.
And they are one of the big offenders. Sorry to shout out about that, but we know, it's
per
common
capita,
knowledge.
Per capita.
Biggest
producer of plastic waste. But even doubly shocking, who's the second biggest per capita of plastic waste? The UK.
Yeah, that's a disgrace.
Yeah, it really is. That's not a league that we should feel proud of. So I think with all the work on solutions, so by bringing plastic free to the fore, where we need to give all those solutions a lot of oxygen, because it's very easy for us to say we can't because, look at healthcare, or you need plastic in healthcare. We have many doctors in the NHS who are saying plastic has to be taken out of healthcare. It's an unhealthy material for us. So with all of these things, we need alternative materials and systems. So that's why any encouragement, any kind of real push or drive to build awareness around plastic free, that's a massive focus for us, because people need solutions.
People need solutions because they don't know where to start. I want to touch on a couple of things before we wrap, Shan. It's really back to this point of choosing another way. I know when we talked about, you and Fred launching A Plastic Planet, that really it felt like your mission, right? Like this is what all the experiences of life, the highs, the lows, the challenges, et cetera, had brought you to this point, right? And you were going to be able to bring everything, every last quality and instinct and brain cell to this challenge, right? And this is kind of it. Like this is the road forward, right?
This is the one for me. You're totally
this is
right.
The road. And I mean, literally in the depths of your soul, this is kind of your purpose now, right? Having known you for all these years and held you in the highest esteem and loved you so much all these years, you always bring you and you do you, And for those people out there that don't know you, you're not going to rock up necessarily in a three-piece suit, but it might be all in gold. And, you had the sparkly trainers before anyone was pounding the streets of London or New York or wherever with the sparkly trainers. And you really bring yourself. And often we forget who we are, don't we? Because we're trying to conform. I mean, particularly with kids in school, they're all trying to look the same because it's the ecosystem that they're being shoved into. We lose our own individuality. We lose our own voice with life's experiences. And people go into the corporate world and they're trying inadvertently to look and sound like everyone around them. That has been a magic power of yours, you being you and you doing you and being strong about it. How can you advise other people on you like really being themselves and honoring that? Because it'll make them much more powerful in whatever they decide to do, right?
We all want to belong to a tribe, don't we? It's so true. And somebody gave me a birthday card years ago, and it had this fantastic picture of this little girl on it. And the headline was, "Life's too short to blend in." And it was so me, exactly as you say. And I fit that whole thing of having a personal, you know, look at me, I've had blue hair for nearly 15 years now. And everyone's like, oh, is it because of the ocean? Said, no, I just got bored of my hair, you know, and just what can I do to change it up a bit? And so I think it is really important just to have those little things that are distinctively you and not, I've never wanted to fit into that corporate groove. And a lot of the time people will say glass ceilings and pushing against it and being a woman in business. I've got to tell you, Dee, I've never found it anything but an advantage being a woman.
Yeah, because you were being you. You were being yourself, right?
As you say, you don't know any other way. But it's also been interesting to me to look back at this very varied, disparate career that I've had of all these wonderful roller coaster experiences and the amazing people that I've had around me, because I'm far from a sole player. I'm always a partner in a team. Even if I'm leading that team, I love having great people around me. That's my absolute favorite thing, is building that team. And then here I am, the most unlikely eco-warrior you will ever meet. But I think I've been built for this now. Everything I've done has built me for where I am now. Even the fact that I can sit at the table with Unilever and be credible because I've been in their industry. I know how hard it is. I'm not, you know, from the Greenpeace ranks, and there's great places for Greenpeace, you know, that kind of extreme activism. But being a solutionist now and recognizing...
Love that word, solutionist,
yeah,
totally.
Yeah. We've all got to be solutionists.
There is that great saying,
if you are not an activist today, you're part of the problem. And that's never been more true. So just tap into whatever you find that you are interested in, however tiny it is, and just see how that little acorn may grow. The young people, that's my other massive message through all of this. So I'm part of the advisory board of this group of entrepreneurs, and I know young entrepreneurship is something you're so passionate about.
Totally. Massive.
And just surround yourself with young people. And that's one of the things, you know, as you get older, you recognize you have to keep current. You've got to surround yourself by youth. It's so important. And there is no age barriers nowadays anywhere.
Which I love, right?
Yes, so love it. It's just, if you are absolutely you, I don't even recognize the age I am. I don't even think about it. I've definitely got one of those Dorian Gray mirrors, I've been calling them, as that is, you know, the young, where I just have no idea. And I'm not interested in really.
It's all a state of mind, isn't it?
Getting older, yeah. It's just, you know, if you've got to celebrate all of that. Don't push back against it, but surround yourself by youth and don't be paranoid about how you're aging and how you're looking, because that's a miserable road. You're only ever going to get older, and it's better than the alternative. So embrace it.
100%. And also, it's about engagement. I mean, my whole thing is it's about acting, right? Like, just act. You're frightened, act. You know, you're worried, just do something. Right? Action will help you find a way through all of this, right? One last question, Shan. You know, you for many years have worked with tons of entrepreneurs, tons of business people. You've mentored and guided many. What's the best piece of advice you've been given? And you've been given many over the years. And sometimes when you get older and you're more experienced, you get less advice because you're the one, you know, giving the advice where required and where requested. But what's the one thing that sort of sat with you?
This might sound a bit random, but there is a book that somebody gave me some years ago, and I think they should teach it at school. And it's a book called The Four Agreements. And I think that if you want to have any kind of resilience in that roller coaster of entrepreneurship or just living on the planet, to be honest, just being a human being, you need a level of resilience. And that book, The Four Agreements, it's a translation. So I think certainly the beginning bit, you know, you might get a little bit lost. But when you hit the four agreements, and I'm not going to say what they are because you have to wade through it.
We are going to put that in the notes.
Yeah. Yes, you have to read them. They are exactly, if you live your life with the four agreements, you will be happy. That's like a cast iron money back guarantee because they're so simple and yet they're so unbelievably deep and powerful. And I made my sons read them. I've made my husband read that book. You know, so many of my friends are, and you can get it on Audible and you can listen to it. And I highly recommend that wherever you are in your path, then read the four agreements and really, really focus on those. And the road ahead will be so much smoother.
Oh my God. And you know what? We need to be looking to the road ahead, right? We can't be looking in the rearview mirror of our car, right? We have to be looking at that super mega power highway ahead of us. So, yeah. Okay, last question. Give us one of the four.
Okay. One of the four, and it's one of my favorites, is it's not personal.
Yeah.
And it's not personal. How simple is that? And yet everything we make personal. Oh, so Dee, you didn't call me. That's because you don't like me. It's all about me. Somehow, you know, oh, this has happened. Well, of course it did, because that's just how it is for me. It's nothing to do with you. You know, and when you realize, and particularly in the world of business, it's not personal. And you recognize that everybody's got that stuff going on in their lives and it's not all about you. Then it's such an empowering thing to realize. And also to realize if you're not their cup of tea, that's not personal either.
Yeah. It's, you know, fine. It's fine. Yeah, just move on, right?
Move on. And just, so I think it's not personal is such an empowering thing to wake up and realize that it's not all about you. And then you just look after the things that are about you. And that's massively freeing. And exactly as you say, that whole thing of looking in the rearview mirror. You know, we take our past and like this chair I'm sitting on, we put it in front of us and we clamber over it. And then we take it again and put it in front of us. And that whole thing, that freeing of knowing every minute is fresh opportunity. Just because it didn't happen before doesn't mean it's not going to happen again. You know, everything could be fine. We don't know. You always do your best. And stop taking the past and using it as an obstacle to climb over for your future.
I couldn't agree more.
That's a great visual metaphor for me as well, is everything is possible. And my final little business message is when you have that little moment, that imposter syndrome moment, say, why me? You know, why should I set up this business trying to turn off the plastic tap? Why should I be doing any of that? Why should we set up plastic free, all of this stuff? And then you have to ask yourself, why not?
Why not?
Why not?
Well, on that note, why not everybody, including us, on a daily basis, right? On a daily basis.
No idea of the power that you have.
Right. Oh my God. Anyway, listen, you are the greatest. Thank you, Shan.
Oh, you're the greatest, Dee. I call you Diamond Dee for a reason.
Oh, I love you so much. Hi everyone, Dee here. I hope you enjoyed this incredible episode with my amazing guest. I hope you're enjoying the series. We'd love to hear from you, so do DM me and tell me all your stories of second curving. Lots of love.